sometimes dragons. They all are kind of dealing with some of the same issues, but we're thinking about like how kids would actually be able to deal with those issues and think about those issues. Because this could be a very different book as a young adult book. And spoiler alert, there is a version of this book where it is a young adult book. And it was weird. And it didn't really work because it didn't deal with things the way that I kind of wanted to. That was part of my working with publishers where they asked me to write it as a young adult book. And I wrote it and it wasn't the book that I wanted to write.
Interesting. You have a website at Kate Ristau, so KateRistau.com. Are there other ways readers can discover more about you and your work?
I spend way too much time on Facebook. And if you also check out my website, I have events pages there where I constantly do events. And if anybody wants me to come talk at schools, I do that for free. I talk for free at schools and libraries. So I just got done with a series at the Tigard Library where we just talked about writing and NaNoWriMo and writing a book in a month. And we actually had a student who wrote a book in a month. And I just wanted to clap and scream and say, great. So my favorite thing is actually going and talking to classes in schools.
Asturian's Curse is the first in the Clockbreaker series. When can we expect the second book?
The second one is already written. It just needs revision. And I had waited to revise as I wanted the book to be out and made sure that they weren't going to make any more big changes to it. So now I am starting revision on that in January. Right now I'm writing something brand new and editing that, and it's great. It's fun as you are a writer and as you work on all these different projects to see how your writing develops and how your writing changes and how you deal with problems and how you kind of get better. And in a lot of ways, I think my dialogue and my action like has been good and is getting better. But what's improving as I'm revising is the rest of the world. Like, how do I make people like feel like they're really there and connect with my characters and with the setting itself? So more books are coming.
Well, I appreciate you talking to me. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners about your book, Clockbreakers, Asturian's Curse?
I just think it's a fantastic book because I love the characters, I really do, and I love the story, and fun things are happening, and if you read through the book and you get to the very end, there's a twist at the very end, too, for the next book that sets it up and says, there's more things going on than we're realizing, so pick it up, enjoy it.
Kate Ristau, thank you so much for talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice a board meeting in writing, please email monica@kboo.org.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today is cartoonist and globetrotting journalist Ted Rall, whose new book is a graphic biography of NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Ted, welcome back to Words and Pictures.
Thanks for having me, S.W. In the interest of the topic here, I should ask you what the S and the W stand for, since you're not entitled to the privacy of your initials.
Sticky Wicket.
Okay. Is that true?
It's true for the purposes of the show, yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
Every time you're in town, you come into the studio, which I'm delighted by, sometimes accompanied by Matt Boris. I think the first time that you came through, you were still president of the American Association of Editorial Cartoonists.
That's right. So that means it was sometime probably in 2009.
That seems like an organization that's not in its heyday like it used to be.
Yeah, like the American Association of Whalebone Corset Makers, the American Association of Buggy Whip Manufacturers. Yeah, we've seen better days. But unlike those things, there's still actually a demand for what we do. What we are dealing with is a serious economic problem of just the model of how to get it to the people and get paid. I mean, there have never been as many political cartoonists being read by as many people in the United States. The problem is that the profession has been deprofessionalized so that it's hard for those cartoonists to get paid. They're all online, but we used to be in newspapers and magazines that paid us. So what you're losing is the person who lives and breathes politics morning, noon, and night, and then has the training in the background and the bandwidth to just think about drawing political cartoons. That's what's going.
Well, it seems like so many other professions where employees have been turned into contractors, and that's happened to journalists and writers.
Yeah, each year you're going to earn less than the year before. Yeah, it's definitely a downward progression. And it's weird because more people see you than ever before. So you're more famous than you ever were before, but you're getting paid less and less.
Well, I read this essay that you wrote right after the massacre at the Charlie Hebdo magazine headquarters in Paris, where you said that there were more employed cartoonists at Charlie Hebdo magazine than at all the daily papers in America these days.
I think I said like the four or five most populous states. Like, right. There's certainly, I think they killed 10 cartoonists there. And there are not 10 cartoonists working in the states of California, Texas, New York, Florida, maybe another big one like Illinois. It's pretty crazy. Here in the U.S., there's probably about 18 full-time cartoonists, which compares very unfavorably, by the way, with Iran and Zambia, countries like that.
Well, you know, in Iran, they do jail cartoonists, but here they just sort of starve them, I guess.
Yeah, I think in Iran, actually, even when they jail them, they still get paid. So, I think that might I might go for that gig, depending on what the cell looks like.
Well, you, like me, are a dual national.
Yes.
You hold an American passport and a French passport. So it makes me wonder why...
Wait, what's yours? What's the other one?
I'm UK.
Okay.
So we're both the EU,
yeah.
Which is cool. So it does make me wonder why you just don't run off to a country that appreciates cartoonists, where you could draw comics, bande dessinée in France, and get a lot more appreciation for your work.
It has crossed my mind.
Do you just like the hate, you know, that you get here in the U.S.?
Or I'm American, you know? I mean, this is home. It's hard to imagine. I mean, look, I love France, and I can really see retiring there, and that might come up sooner rather than later, the way things
down
are going.
Down in Sauve, it seems to be so many people down there these days, American cartoonists down in the south of France.
That's true. Crumb and a lot of others. But I think that it would be hard. It's not the hate that I love. It's just that, you know, this is my entire infrastructure. My people are here, my friends, my family. You know, I really admire immigrants. I mean, you know, it's so hard to just pack up and leave everything. Even if you don't have any property, even if you're poor in your country of origin, the ability to just give up all those ties of your family, and it's just devastating. I don't think you get over it for generations.
So you mentioned the subject of abandoning your own country to go and live in a new place, which is kind of a perfect segue to talk about your book, Snowden. It's a sort of cartoon biography of Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower. And this has an interesting story. You decided that you wanted to go off to Moscow and talk to Edward Snowden in person, and your publisher, Seven Stories Press, was all ready to foot the bill.
Yeah, they were. That's necessary. You're writing a biography of someone who's alive. Obviously, you can interview them, and you should, extensively if you can. I've always had an interest in this form, and I read a lot of bios. Seven Stories said that they would send me to go, but unfortunately, Edward wasn't interested in talking to me. I still don't know why. But anyway, so the point is, Snowden refused, and so I was kind of unhappy while I was working on the book. I just pulled together everything I could find from magazine articles and newspapers, pieces, and so on, and compiled it. There are no actual bios. There's two books. There's Glenn Greenwald's No Place to Hide, which is really not about Snowden. It's really about the NSA leaks. I mean, I'm simplifying, but mostly. And there's a Luke Harding book called The Snowden Files, which has a little biographical stuff. And I lifted some stuff from there. It's all cited in the footnotes. But there's a lot of inaccuracies in that book because it came out so quickly. And it's not really his fault. But this book is like the only book that's just a bio. And I don't know. It's funny that he hasn't done his own. But in any event, I sent the script and the completed proof to Snowden via his ACLU attorney, Ben Wisner. And fortunately, we did at that point get back a bunch of edits that fixed some of the mistakes that are like in the Luke Harding book and other places. So I feel good about it. I feel like, okay, well, this book is, if nothing else, it's accurate. It summarizes not only the programs and what they do in a simple, accurate way, but also his life story and the dilemma that he faced.
And there were some pretty substantial mistakes that had been repeated throughout the coverage of him, like how he exited Hong Kong for Russia, for example.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people kind of got the idea that Snowden might be a Russian spy or plant or operative because of the fact that he went to Russia. And also, they kind of, there was reporting that stated that China had turned a blind eye to his departure from Hong Kong, which is administered by China, and that this was something that the U.S. government had a right to be angry about. But that's not true at all. What happened was that the Chinese really viewed Edward Snowden as a hot potato and were eager to have him leave. And they let his representatives know in no uncertain terms that the sooner he left, the happier they would be. So they were worried, actually, that he might be arrested by the Chinese and then deported to the United States, even though there is no extradition treaty, to my knowledge, between China and the U.S. So what happened is that the heat was on Snowden and his people. So he left. And when he went to the airport in Hong Kong, his passport was valid. He had valid plane tickets, passport, and an invitation visa with the Republic of Ecuador. So the plan was to fly from Hong Kong to Moscow to Havana to Ecuador. You can't get a direct flight from Hong Kong to Ecuador. So while he was in the air, then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton turned off electronically his passport. There's a little bug in your passport, which you may have noticed, and a little logo on the front if you have a new passport. I think they all have that now. And so they just flipped a switch and effectively rendered him stateless so that when he arrived at Moscow Sheremetyevo 2 airport to change planes, he was informed, "You have problem with passport. You cannot go on next plane on Aeroflot to Havana." So he wasn't able to go.
You think you've had problems changing planes.
Yeah, no doubt. So he was stuck there like in that Tom Hanks movie, Terminal, you know, just for over a month, like washing his underwear in the sink in like the waiting area. So word to the wise, always pack extra underwear and socks. If you have extra underwear and socks, you can survive anything.
So he's been, ever since then, he's been renewing his residency visa every couple of years. And
he essentially has Russian political asylum. Uh-huh. And so that's every 2 years, and he's renewed it once, so he's good for another 2 years.
And his girlfriend, I mean, this is some trust and dedication. She just came over and joined him. And
yeah, I mean, you know, you got to imagine this from her point of view. I mean, as far as we know, and there's no reason to not believe this, he never told her before he left about any of this. You know, he knew that she would have been questioned by the FBI and debriefed, and he wanted to make sure that she couldn't spill the, you know, that she had nothing to, she wasn't inculpated in his crime. So he just split. One morning, he just left like he was going to work. And instead, you know, it's like, I'm going out for cigarettes. And then he, you know, he went to the airport in Honolulu where they lived and vanished. So you can imagine the feelings that she went through. I mean, she's living with this guy. She's in love with him. They've been together for years. It's a serious relationship. And you know, suddenly she comes home and he's packed up and gone. She knows not where. And then like a few weeks later, there's an international manhunt and he's the world's most wanted man, her boyfriend. And he's being called a traitor and a cyber criminal and a hacker by the president of the United States. It must have made her head spin. But obviously she's a smart person and she wrapped her head around it eventually. And so they're back together.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and I'm joined in the studio today by Ted Rall, the author of the graphic biography, Snowden. And those who've seen the Laura Poitras documentary film, Citizen 4, have seen how Edward Snowden hooked up with Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian journalist, and Laura Poitras, and filmed these days of going through the NSA files in this hotel room in Hong Kong. And it's interesting that when he finally went on TV, they threw up a fake backdrop of Hong Kong, which is how people figured out where he was.
Yeah, that is funny. I thought they also figured it out from the stuff in the hotel room, like the lamp, like people who knew that hotel were said, oh, I stayed in that hotel. So you know how hotels have certain distinctive furnishings. That's why you should always just stay in like a Marriott, because they all look the same.
So in the book that you have out from Seven Stories Press, Snowden, one of the points you make about Snowden is that geography was, in some sense, destiny. Edward Snowden grew up in the suburb of Washington, D.C., that it was sort of a company town for the NSA.
That's right. We're talking about Crofton, Maryland. He's not born there. He's born in South Carolina, but he grew up as a little kid in Crofton all throughout his youth. It's only 5 miles away from NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland, which if you've driven around there, you will see from two major highways the big NSA exit. It's pretty obvious. And if you live in Crofton, most people in your neighborhood have at least one parent who works at the NSA or works for another intelligence agency, perhaps the CIA or the DIA or the MAPS office. There's a lot of intelligence agencies that people don't even know about because they don't get much press, but they're also handle highly classified information. And there's also a lot of security contractors. Snowden, it must be remembered, didn't spend much of his career working for the federal government ever. He spent most of it working for private contractors or subsidiaries of the NSA or CIA. He bounced around a lot. I guess he was an ambitious guy. And then at a certain point, he kind of, once he realized that he wanted to collect these documents and become a whistleblower, he changed jobs a lot so that he would have different kinds of access, allowing him to obtain different kinds of information that he would be able to collect and eventually reveal. So he was very methodical and planned. But his last job was at a private NSA contracting firm called Booz Allen Hamilton in Honolulu.
And one of the points you make is there's not a whole lot of idealists working for these contractors that deal with the NSA. And he was one of them, or he became one of them.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, there's one of the statistics when I was doing the research for the book that boggled my mind was the idea that 1.4 million Americans had access to many or all of the same highly classified files that Snowden had access to. And that blew me away for two reasons. First of all, it really underscores the size of America's security state infrastructure. I mean, you know, we don't have 1.4 million editorial cartoonists or radio hosts or journalists. And, you know, I mean, I would argue that a country that had 1.4 million journalists would probably be more of a democracy than what we have. You know, we don't have 1.4 million soccer coaches or priests. You know, why do we have so many people working in this profession? This is more people than Walmart employ, and it's the nation's largest employer. So literally, the security state is a major economic factor. If these people all went out of business, if these NSA were closed, CIA and so on, and all these people were thrown out onto the streets, you'd have another housing crash, the likes of which we saw in 2008. It would be a major economic reckoning, because this is trillions of dollars that go into Americans spying on one another. It's not really dissimilar from East Germany under the Stasi, when husbands and wives would sometimes discover that they had both been paid separately to spy on one another at the end of the Cold War when the wall came down. So that blew me away. And then the other thing that that number, that one in a million thing, brought home was, you know, Edward Snowden. Why him? I mean, you know, how is it that 1,399,998, I'm going to say 98, because there's also Thomas Drake, who was a whistleblower in the 2000s, and I talked to him in the book. What is it, like, literally these one or two guys out of 1.4 million, what's unique about them? You know, I mean, are they right and everyone else is crazy? Or is everyone else right and they're crazy? Or is there something else going on? And what is it about them that made them feel that this was the right thing to do and the right way to act? So those are the questions that I was interested in exploring. And I engaged in a little bit of armchair psychoanalysis, trying to get to the bottom of, you know, hey, you know, this is a very idealistic young man, a libertarian. Certainly libertarianism feeds into this. Libertarians are very interested in privacy rights. But, you know, what? None of the other 1.4 million were libertarians? Of course they were. Many. And then what about the concern over the constitutional violations, which are unquestioned? Defenders of these NSA programs argue that they're necessary to protect us from terrorism. And that's a perfectly valid argument to make. But it's not valid to make the argument that they're legal, and nobody really does. They're not legal programs. They're not authorized by Congress. They haven't been authorized by the Patriot Act. They kind of have a jerry-rigged quality of baling wire and twine holding them together legally, and a bunch of public opinions issued, for example, by the so-called FISA court, which isn't a real court and authorized by the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it's kind of amazing to me that other people didn't have these legal problems, you know, the Fourth Amendment violations on a broad scale. You're talking about the mass interception and collection of every digital and analog communication possible in the United States and in throughout most of the world. So we are talking about, if you're listening to me, every one of your emails, all of your text messages, all of your voice over internet calls, all of your bank statements, your credit card statements, you name it, even your mail, your mail is being scanned and tracked through the Postal Service. So it's amazing to me that nobody else thought that was a problem. You know, he was a Boy Scout, but hey, I was a Boy Scout. I mean, you know, it's like there's millions of Boy Scouts. You know, his parents were divorced. Yeah, my parents were divorced. I mean, there's a lot of things about him that just are very ordinary. In fact, he's really not remembered by his classmates or the people he was in scouts with. He was boring. He was not an interesting person.
You talked with some of the people he grew up with. And he was a cipher. I think this is one reason why people are so fascinated with him, is because there's so little information about him, and he's not very forthcoming himself, as you found out. And so, yeah, he seemed like the perfect person, a very tech-savvy kid, liked video games, was an introvert, and the perfect person to go into this industry.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Although it's funny because he had such an incredibly unorthodox background. He was a, you know, kind of an unusual character for someone that you'd expect to become a systems analyst working at the highest levels of national intelligence, which is what he was by the time he was 25. I mean, 21 years old, he's got nothing going on in his life at all. He'd washed out of the military. He'd tried to join the U.S. Army. He joined special forces. He thought he was going to liberate the people of Iraq from the oppression of Saddam Hussein. He believed in all that. He was a right winger. He was a nationalist, a patriot. But he washed out. He broke both of his feet in a basic training. So he went from, in 4 years, from being just, you know, a loser to being a six-figure intelligence analyst with access to the same data as the President of the United States. And he could watch drone strikes in real time. It's a remarkable story.
One of the people that you talked to, you sat down and talked to for the Snowden book, is Thomas Drake. And he was a high-level NSA executive, a techie, very tech-savvy.
Yeah.
And he tried to work through the system. He had access to all the same stuff that Ed Snowden had. You know, it's funny, according to your conversation with him, the thing that really offended him was the waste of money, all of the money that was going to friendly contractors who were making a very expensive system rather than a cheaper, more efficient system that wouldn't have gathered mass records. It would have targeted small numbers of records and been a lot more efficient.
Yeah, that's totally true. I mean, I don't think it's fair to say that Drake did not care about privacy violations. He did, and that was part of his complaint. And I think it grew to offend him over time more and more. But yeah, there was definitely, for him, he was a whistleblower in large part because he opposed a program that was costing billions of dollars to do something that another program within NSA could have done for millions of dollars, so literally a 1,000 times less. And he felt that it was a tremendous waste of taxpayer money. He also thought that the cheaper program was better, that it was more focused and directed at law enforcement and protecting the American people in a way that the programs that were more expensive were not. But those more expensive programs were defended by people in the Senate who were in charge of Senate oversight and within the big muckety-mucks in the military infrastructure, because they all had cozy deals with the contractors that were involved and were all going to go work. So it was all corrupt. So he was really an anti-corruption whistleblower as well as a privacy whistleblower. And he worked his way. He did everything that you're supposed to do. He went to his bosses. He went to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He talked to his congressman. He tried everything. They all blew him off and ignored him. And finally, he went to the Baltimore Sun and told them what was what, but not very much. I mean, compared to the Snowden dumps, I mean, you know, we're talking about like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of 1% as much information. Anyway, it was enough to piss off the FBI and the federal government, and they raided his house and set out to destroy his life and his marriage and his relationship with his children. And in large part succeeded, and he's now working at an Apple store in Maryland, outside of D.C.
They tried him, but the case fell apart.
Yeah, they tried him on espionage charges, which is like, excuse me, but don't you have to actually be giving away classified information to agents of a foreign power to be guilty of espionage? That's a leak. A leak and espionage are not the same thing, but the U.S. government has repeatedly tried to conflate those two things. For example, in the cases of Chelsea Manning and Daniel Ellsberg and Julian Assange. So it's they're not the same, but they like to make things confusing. And yeah, it's gross. But Tom Drake is an important character in this whole story, even though he's unknown to most Americans, because Snowden looked at what happened to other whistleblowers before he decided to go on the lam. And he realized quickly that, first of all, federal whistleblower protection laws do not cover him, and that to the extent that they cover anyone, they're really not enforced and they're a joke. And so, you know, it's like having anyone investigate themselves. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, I promise that I will not prosecute you if you screw me over. No, I'm going to try to prosecute you. That's the nature of power. And he knew that as soon as he did this, he would become an enemy of the state and that they would treat him accordingly. And so, I mean, obviously no one wants to be cooling their heels in a prison cell as Chelsea Manning is for the next 35 years. But I think aside from that, there was also a broader point for Snowden, which is he wanted the story to stay alive. And one of the ways that the story could stay alive is with him being free to give interviews. You know, Mumia Abu-Jamal can give interviews and talk publicly, even though he's behind bars. But Chelsea Manning cannot. So that's what would have happened to him.
Well, and in these days of Skype and satellite TV, Ed Snowden can address huge audiences, do Q&As. There's a couple of big tech conferences coming up that he's going to be speaking to. This is kind of his bread and butter these days.
Oh, yeah. No, he pulls in five-figure speaking gigs for going on Skype in his living room in Moscow and speaking to South by Southwest, where I saw him, or wherever. Yeah, it's kind of like, aside for the whole my government wants to kill me with a drone thing, it's a pretty sweet gig.
Well, towards the end of the book, Snowden, you take out your crystal ball a little bit and look into the future. And one of the things that you mention here is you talk to a source at the who currently works at the NSA, who says sooner rather than later, the web is going to go dark. This is the intelligence community's worst nightmare. And you asked, because everyone will be using solid encryption? And he says, yes, we won't be able to see anything. By the way, I'll pimp KBOO membership a little bit, that people who join KBOO can get a thumb drive with lots of encryption software on it for their personal use while surfing the web and using email.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that's something everyone should do. I mean, they're actually...
So what do you see as being... Keep using your crystal ball here. What do you see as being the ultimate upshot of all the stuff that's gone down in the Snowden case?
I think that we're going to end up with, in the same way that we have become increasingly a society of haves and have-nots economically, we're also going to become a society of haves and have-nots in other respects. Like, for example, there are information elites. Newspapers will only be for people who can afford to pay like $8 a copy and who get news that way. And the web, the cheap BuzzFeed news, will be free.
And the aggregators.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in that same way, there are going to be privacy haves and have-nots. People who can afford privacy in the same way that they can live in a gated community in the real world will be able to, in the virtual world, to protect themselves by installing PGP encryption and other better, even better encryption protocols on their systems. And then, you know, I mean, look, these things you could argue are all available to the masses, sort of. For example, you can buy an iPhone 6 and it's encrypted point to point, which is great. Or you can get an app called Signal, which is free, and you can, but you have to have a smartphone to use it, right? So if you're poor, you have a flip phone or you use a pay phone, so you can't encrypt your calls and you can't protect yourself. So poor people don't have either the access to the, you know, the spiffy new iPhone 6, or they don't have the access to the latest encryption software, which is always what you need, the latest, or they don't have the knowledge to protect themselves, that they know that there's a problem, that they know that this is an issue, or they're just working 70 hours a week and maybe they don't have time to look into all this crap and try to protect themselves. So there's privacy haves and have nots. Already there are. I'm a have. I have Signal. I'm going to buy an iPhone 6. But, you know, I can afford a $1,200 telephone, as insane as that is, barely. But most people cannot. And most people are not going to go to this trouble. So I think the way it's going to work is that poor people will not go dark to NSA, and rich people will.
Well, the book is Snowden. The author is Ted Rall. So, Ted, tell our listeners how they can find out more about your work.
Well, just go to my website, Ted Rall Online, which is at rall.com, or you could just Google Ted Rall if you forget. And there's also, obviously, all the usual Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. But I would much prefer that you buy my books from independent bookstores.